Transportation Economic Development, Joint Ways and Means, Tuesday, June 12th. We're heading for Sunny Drive. We're getting started about 7 minutes late. We appreciate you being here. Laurie is here from, let's say, Fiscal Office, and Dupuy is representing us as the committee subcommittee assistant. And we'll start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 666 and recognize Senator Roger Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Member of the committee?
Member of the committee.
There's a lot of things going on around the building this morning, so people are spread pretty thin. I'm Roger Beyer, State Senator, District 15, here today to speak to you about Senate Bill 666. Now, this bill came out of the Business of Labor and Economic Development Committee in the Senate. I'm here today to urge adoption of the A4 amendments to the bill and move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The bill, as it came out of the Business and Labor Committee, had, if you look on page 9 of the bill, you will see that it has an appropriation of $60,000 general fund in the bill for the purpose of setting up a fund or the possible payment of attorney fees if a judge so ordered the Department of Employment to pay attorney to award attorney's fees. That is why the bill was sent to the Committee on Ways and Means, because of course it had more than a $50,000 fiscal. I'm here urging you to remove that appropriation and send the bill to the floor without that. Then any fees, any attorney fees awarded by a judge would have to come out of fines and penalties, interest penalties assessed to employers. They could not use federal funds to pay attorney fees. That is against federal law. It says so very clearly in the bill that no federal monies shall be used to award attorney fees. A question has come up, what happens if there's not enough money in an account of fines and penalties to pay attorney fees and a judge might award? I can't answer that question. I would let that be answered by the legal folks. I don't know, that was never brought up in the committee when we talked about it on the business committee. So that is what we have before you.
Senator Beyer, do we have the A4 amendments?
Yeah.
I hope you do.
Chair Butler or Senator Carno, they are the last page in the packet I handed out.
Okay. I did give it to the committee staff about a month ago or so.
Let me, can I ask a few questions?
Certainly.
Relative to the bill, Senator Beyer. First of all, just referring to page 2, I understand that in section 4, I found out that section 903 of the Social Security Act is the Reed Act money, and I understand that that probably has already been accomplished in another bill that we passed out of the of this committee, 5048. So that section may have. And you're shaking your head yes, or is that...
Chair Butler, yes. The Reed Act language is in House Bill 5048, which just passed out of the House and it's on its way to the Senate. And that's a bill that also has some continuous appropriation languages for state agencies, and the Legislative Fiscal Office in Ways and Means inserted that language since it's pretty much essential to the Employment Department's budget for 0103.
I think that's a continuous appropriations for about 13 different
funds. And this Reed Act language is in that same bill.
Okay. And then let me, I think in four different places, it changes the burden of proof that, where it indicates, that on page 4, line 9, 10, 11, and 12, where it talks about the director has the burden of proof that the tax determined by the director or authorized representative of the director is correct, as opposed to the prima facie evidence. Is there a, that's over on line 5 on pages 21 through 23, and again on 7 on line 6, 7, 8, and on line on page 8 down on lines 23 through 26. What's the reason that it shifts the burden of proof to the director?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what brought this bill forward was the fact that the Employment Department has, in the past, they have gone into people and with the assumption that every single person is an employee, and whether they be independent contractors or not. As you know, there are very strict rules in Oregon as to determine who is an independent contractor and who is an employee. And we started with the bill that would assume everyone is an independent contractor, basically, until the department proves otherwise. And working with the Federal Bureau of Labor on the issue, trying to bring the bill into so that Oregon's Employment Department would not fall out of conformity with the Federal Bureau of Labor, we had to reduce it so that only the only thing we could really change the burden of proof on is the tax rate itself. And it's brought forward because the Department of Employment has not allowed employers, when they say someone's an employer, they have not allowed their employees to be deposed prior to hearings. So it's very hard for employers then, when they're challenging these decisions, to find out evidence beforehand, and it makes attorney fees for the employers very costly because the department has not allowed them to see what records they're looking at. So what we've done here is changed the burden of proof on the tax rate only, and then allowed the granting of attorney fees if the judge finds that that's a may, that's not a shall. It's up to the discretion of the court. And also says that the department employees shall be subject to discovery, same as we started out as with rules of a certain civil proceedings, and the Federal Bureau said that was too onerous and be too time-consuming, so we went strictly to that the discovery may be obtained by deposition upon oral examination or by written requests for production of documents or things and requests for admission. So that is what brings the bill forward, Mr. Chair, is some problems that some employers in the state have had with the I guess challenging Employment Department decisions.
And let's see, I have the discovery that's outside of the Administrative Procedure Act. The discovery is my understanding that other state agencies don't have that same level of discovery responsibility.
That's true, Mr. Chair. This bill would treat the Employment Department different than the Revenue Department or the Workers' Compensation Division. That is very true. But we have not heard the complaints from employers in the state about the other agencies. And the effect by AG, I can't remember for sure now, I'd have to go back to my notes, if it's AG rules, it leaves it up to individual departments as to whether or not they're going to allow discovery prior to hearings, and other agencies do, but the Employment Department has been reluctant to in certain cases, and I don't know about in every case, and that is why that piece was put into the bill.
Relative to the attorney fees themselves, and it may just be in my reading of it, and it might be necessary as a scrivener's note, on page 7, paragraph or subsection 9 of section 10, where it talks about federal monies may not be used to satisfy an award of attorney fees. I assume that on both of those, it's also that shows up in section 11, subparagraph 9 over on page 9. That's on behalf of the department, or by the department, I guess that would be. Is that right? Because attorney's fees, the award of attorney's fees would not necessarily ever be awarded to the department, would they?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that the attorney fees
would ever be awarded by to the department.
No, I don't believe that.
So here, they're just so it's understood that on to the employing unit. Okay.
saying it doesn't make a provision for the department.
Okay. So I had just written in mind that satisfying award of attorney's fees by the department, I assumed that that's what it was, so, okay. Okay, those are just the questions that I had as I've gone through it. Are there other, thank you very much, Senator Breyer, are there other questions that members of the committee may have? Representative Johnson, you're welcome.
Thank you, I apologize for being late.
I just wanted to clarify the dash A for amendments, our amendments that sent us to Breyer.
Yes.
We should have added to.
Yep.
Okay, Representative Johnson?
I do have a question, and I beg the chair's indulgence, this is sort of a freshman question. Will this make the burden on this agency different than other state agencies?
Yes, it will, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson. We, as I said just before you walked in, it will change the burden of proof, different from the Revenue Department and Workers' Comp Department specifically. And the reason we, as a committee, chose to do that was the fact that the complaints we've received about this department and not about the other two. So.
And again, you may have said this, voluminous complaints?
I'm searching my high school grammar definition of voluminous.
Lots of them.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, lots is a subjective term. I would say in my definition, many complaints about the Department of Employment. There is one particular attorney and that with clients who have been, you know, working on the department and being opposed to the department. That was subject to what brought forward House Bill, and I can't remember the number. There is a House Bill that the interim committee held a hearing last session on this issue and brought forward a certain House bill that's still in the business committee in the House, and that's parts of that bill are now in Senate Bill 666. But I have had other complaints about the Employment Department, specifically the complaints about independent contractor and the almost impossibility of to make the proof of a person is an independent contractor, not an employer.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Johnson.
My brief time in the legislature has instructed me that I guess I'm always a little tiny bit anxious when we're passing legislation that speaks to specific cases, and you seem to make reference in what you just said, unless I misunderstood you, that there was a particular attorney who had generated the lion's share of those complaints, and I'm just trying to get a sense of how widespread the problem is that this bill addresses.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, perhaps the Employment Department could better answer that question. I don't know how many other cases they have being challenged on whether or not persons are independent contractors or employees.
May I reserve that question?
Certainly,
for the department?
We can. We will have the department. This is brought back a flood of memories. All of a sudden, I go back at least 20 years when I had a case in my office where we represented a client doing their quarterly unemployment returns, and the laundry service that they used was in Idaho,
mm-hmm.
and they were required to mm-hmm. pay payroll taxes to the laundry service. And I remember now, as I say, it brought back a flood of memories all of a sudden, that what happened was that the laundry service was charging, the particular client had a certain amount of towels and other things that were required to be washed every week, and they paid $75 a week or something for the towels, and including some laundry soap and some other things that were all included in that. And a fairly aggressive Department of Employment person came in and said they're not registered to do business in Oregon, therefore the laundry service is an employee. And what we did was we went ahead and set a claim when her washing machine broke down. We sent a claim to the Department of Employment to have them come and fix it because we figured that machine was unemployed at that particular point. Anyway, it didn't go very far, and I ended up paying several hundred dollars. The bottom line was that we had to contact a labor attorney in Bend who did this kind of work, and he said, I would guess the amount that you're talking about is a total of about $800 to $1,000. Is that right? And I said, that's exactly right. Are you familiar with these people? I've given you a whole bunch of information, and I may have spilled my guts to you when I shouldn't have. And he said, no, he said, that's about what it takes to fight one of these claims is $800 to $1,000. We just finished one with a beauty shop that was about $800 to $1,000, and it's just easier to pay the claim than it is to go get a lawyer. So this goes back, and I appreciate what you're saying.
That's fairly stunning when you consider how many significant border towns there are, notably Portland and Vancouver pop mm-hmm. into my mind.
Mm-hmm. I think this is probably an old practice of an old former time. Certainly we had one CPA firm that was certainly a lot smarter in the way that we did business when we encouraged, you know, employers to go and get information about when they were writing checks to ABC Laundry and those kinds of things.
I'll be interested to have Ms. Crosley start her testimony by assuring us that that's not the case anymore.
I'm sure that's probably not, but when you mentioned that there's a lawyer that practices in that's what brought back that flood of memories, was the lawyer that we've had contact with that said, I can tell you about the size of the claim, because it's not worth it. They'll push it up to that dollar amount, and above that dollar amount, they won't push it. They'll back away. But that, again, this is over 20 years ago, so different time, different era, back when you were still a youngster. Yes, ripping the contract.
Respectfully, Senator Beyer, I'm not sure that you answered my question or I heard the answer. Is it good policy to have the burden for one state agency be different than the others?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, yeah, in my opinion, yes, or I would not have sent this bill down here and be now here testifying in favor of this bill. I think it is when you have one agency that has proved harder to work with and has not allowed private citizens to access to documents that they need to defend themselves. I think at that point in time, when you have an agency acting like that, then that is our job to take measures to change that. And that is why this bill is here. It clearly would treat the Employment Department different than the other agencies in this arena. And maybe all agencies should be treated the same way, but we won't know until we see what happens with one agency and whether or not this cripples them or if it actually makes them more responsive to the public. I think it will do the latter, make them more responsive to the public.
Thank you.
Representative Patrick,
recognize. My only concern in shifting the burden of proof to the Employment Department is the Employment Department, except through subpoena and other things, is not in a position to have that information readily available and know what's there. And I'm just concerned that it's going to cost the state a lot more money and it's going to take employers away from their businesses as they're dragged into these hearings and a whole bunch of discovery. As a lawyer, I know that we spend a lot of time and a lot of money doing the discovery process, just guessing at what kind of information they have. And so did anyone testify to that? That's a primary concern of mine, because I would feel, at least in this case, that if the Employment Department brings the claim, then the employer can then come forward with all the information that they have to show somebody is an independent contractor. Otherwise, they're going to have to do interrogatories and ask all these questions. And so I'm just wondering, does that put more of a burden on an employer as opposed to less of a burden? I had one of these. I learned a lot about this because I had one of these independent contractor claims during the interim, and I worked a lot with the director's office and the employer and everyone else in regard to this. So I'm just wondering. And then I wasn't here earlier, Senator Beyer, and I was wondering, you said that the Employment Department won't give up information that they have. Could you?
Yeah, that's great, Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge. The Employment Department has been reluctant to release information in their possession that employers need to defend themselves and try to figure out why they're being assessed as they're being assessed in independent contractor cases specifically. And this would require them to give up that information. And yeah, when you get a case to the point where you've got the opposing sides needing to go to discovery, it is costing the employers a lot of money. There's no doubt about it. That's why the attorney fee provision is also in here, with the hope that it's going to make both sides settle a little quicker. And my goal is to keep all cases out of court and out of hearings, but that's not always the case.
Further questions for Senator Beyer? Thank you. I'm sorry, Representative Johnson, recognized?
I think that there is a Labor and Management Committee that helps advise the department. What's their position on this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, the only Management Labor Committee I know of deals with the workers' compensation issues. I'm not aware of one dealing with the Employment Department.
I'll say that and ask the
Thank you agent. Again, Senator Beyer. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have Ms. Crosley here from the Department of Employment.
Good afternoon. I'm Berlina Crosley, and I'm the director of the Oregon Employment Department, and I have Donna Hunter, who is the manager of our unemployment insurance tax section, with me in case there are questions I can't answer. I do have written testimony, and I think you have been talking about some of the major provisions of the bill in areas of deposition, in areas of attorney fees, and now the deletion of the $60,000 general fund. By way of probably introducing comments that I would like to say, I think I'll respond to some of the things that Senator Beyer raised. To the area of depositions, we are covered by the Administrative Procedures Act, and we are under the model rules for agencies that are under the APA, or the Administrative Procedures Act. In fact, as indicated by Senator Beyer, agencies are allowed to determine whether or not depositions are automatically done, or whether they reserve the right to do them on a case-by-case basis. We have exercised those rights. We have worked a lot with our Attorney General's office in that particular area. What this committee needs to know, and I have put on the record both in the substantive committee and will again here, there's only probably been about less than five times we have been asked to depose records. And in the instances regarding these independent contractors, I have never denied a deposition request unless advised by my attorneys to do. So you understand that when we get into a hearing situation, we are also represented by, in this case, the Assistant Attorney General's office. And in the instance for the individuals who brought the case to the House and the Senate's substantive committees, I would have and did advise them that I would, if deposed, which we were, give them the records. So that has not been an issue in this particular case. Regarding the independent contractor status and why they're dealing mostly with independent contractor issues with the Employment Department, many years ago now, the 8-point test that was put in statute and that was supported by both business and labor is determined primarily by the Employment Department. We are the one that actually decides for those other state agencies in most instances, and actually Department of Revenue's administrative rule says they basically defer to our position on those because we do more audits in that particular area. And in fact, most of the cases that are brought on independent contractors do go through the Employment Department, and then those state agencies rely on our determination. So it is not surprising that those issues are mostly in front of the employment department. That was done primarily because of the statutory construction, which was by design, that all three agencies, and in fact, the Construction Contractors Board is another one that uses that determination, that we would all be using the same rather than different approaches to the same taxpayer. So that was by design. On the independent contractor status, we have had very few cases that have gone up through appeal and on then to the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. And I need to tell you that some of those have been very high profile. They've been people like signature gatherers.
We have one now with a temporary agency with the pharmacist.
A temporary agency with the pharmacist is on the way to the Court of Appeals. We have won in every instance. We are very, very careful about what would go forward because we are basically wanting to win, obviously, but win under the current law. And that's why we have raised in substantive committees that if they want us to look at more factors than what the 8 factors are when we apply them, then they need to change the factors rather than trying to prohibit us from using the factors and then making the determinations and saying then that we're wrong in that application.
Ms. Crosley, if I can interrupt right there for just a moment. Do I understand correctly on page 2, lines 15, 16, 17, is that one of the factors, the Internet website? Is that
an
additional
factor? That is one of
the
factors. Right now the current law allows us to use what you would call advertising, and it uses things like business cards and newspapers and those kinds of things. It does not allow, at least the way it has been reviewed, we can't use things like Internet and websites, which weren't even available in the early 1980s when the law was passed.
For the record, the laundress did not have business cards and did
is
not
that
advertise
right?
in the newspaper.
Okay, which is probably one of the reasons they didn't meet that test. So
right.
It does include, we held focus groups around the state. It's somewhere between 6 and 8 focus groups with individuals in the local communities, and based on those comments, the one area of unanimous support was to add something to the law that allowed that as a determination when we're considering independent contractor status. The hearing fees that are in the bill, it says the judge, but if you read the statute modification, it's at the hearings officer level. It's not at the regular judge level at the Court of Appeals. There is no agency that we work generally on independent contractor status that has the administrative law judge at the hearings level award hearing fees. This is a very big deviation from the current law for any administrative agency. It's usually, if attorney fees are awarded, it is done at the court level, not at the administrative hearings level. And he is correct when he says it says may, so it's not a shall, which was one of our concerns, but it still allows hearing attorney fees to be awarded at that administrative level, which is another area of concern. I talked to Mark Gibson from the governor's office just prior to coming in to this hearing, and we had testified against the bills coming in to Ways and Means. And I have been instructed and advised that the governor is still expressing great concern about this bill and would make that known to the leadership, and therefore at this point in time the employment department cannot support the bill as drafted.
Are there questions for Ms. Crosley? Yes, Representative Johnson is recognized.
Thank you. Senator Beyer indicated that he had a file of unhappy folks. Do you have any agency measurement of how satisfied your customers are?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, actually we do. I think I may have actually included on your this is a fairly new thing for us to do in the hearings and tax section. We are audited to standards because we're federally funded. They have federal audit standards where they look at substantiation for our audits, those kinds of things, and if we fail those, we go under a corrective action plan. We felt that that was too far And based on an audit, we needed to know what the real people felt about us as we're auditing. And so we did this last year.
November.
In November. So it's a fairly recent survey. And you can see that, generally speaking, they've been, you understand that we're in a generally adversarial relationship when the tax section is talking to individual employers, because this is the employer side of unemployment insurance. But generally speaking, only 0.5% I believe it was, less than 1% anyway, said that they felt that they were never treated fairly or they were treated unfairly.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, Representative Johnson.
Are you seeking the input of the Labor and Management Committee? And Senator Byrd didn't know if they had a position, do they?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, yes. We have a 12-person, although there's one, I think, person absent now because there was some turnover. But we have a Business Labor Committee that has such individuals that represents Associated Oregon Industry, Fred Myers, some large employers as well as small employers, and then labor, AFL-CIO, for example. I think Teamster's still on there. They're appointed by the governor to advise both the governor and me in policies regarding the unemployment insurance. They have unanimously opposed this bill in its current form.
Yes, one more follow-up.
Follow-up, sir.
Because I see the representative from NFIB, and I want to make sure when you say Fred Meyer and small businesses, what qualifies as a small business? If Freddie's is one of them, I want to make sure that small business really means small business.
It is, but it's the individual businesses, the owners themselves, and NFIB is not a representative on our, currently at least, on our, and I know on the Senate side, who's here, I did testify that he had a taxpayer raise an area of concern, which is expressed, that he expressed in that committee, and I'm sure he can speak for himself, but he did have a taxpayer employer that was not happy with the Employment Department's audit. So he is not, to my knowledge, taking a position on, for me, on our advisory council.
If J.R. comes to you with a member of his association who is not satisfied, is it the agency's standard position that you would try to work with his association to work out his members' concern? And I'm trying to get a sense of, and get you on the record, to state the agency's willingness to try to work through some of these. I continue to be concerned about writing rather sweeping legislation if we're dealing with a paucity of instances where folks couldn't find satisfaction from the agency.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, if anyone brings to my attention, they would have open, I have a very open door policy, so if they came in and advised that, we would very, very much want to work to have the person happy when they leave. Now, sometimes that does not mean we can relieve taxes. I have, and am authorized under the statute to settle cases, and we've reduced penalty and interest pretty significantly if they raise areas of concern that maybe the length of the audit took longer because of things we did, not just things that the employer did. So, yes, I would be more than glad to sit down with anyone. And, frankly, even for the ones that Senator Byrd has raised, we are actually in litigation on a case right now that was referred to, and actually that person testified. We offered many, many times to sit down in my office. I was never called.
Thank you.
Further question, I just wanted to, this is on that question number 4 in the survey. During your long-term experience with the Department of Employment Tax Section, have you been treated fairly? And so less than 0.5% indicates never fairly. Mm-hmm. But I'd also just take a look at that those that say always treated fairly are less than 50%. 42.5% that feel like they're always treated fairly. However, the combination of always and usually is represents something over 70% there. So that's it is interesting to note that that's still less than half believe that they're always treated fairly. So that is, even with some that say never treated fairly, I give them half a percent treated fairly when they were shown the way to the restroom and given a cup of coffee or something like that. Other questions from Ms. Crosby and Ms. Hunter? Thank you very much. We have, I believe, J.L. Wilson signed up. Thank you, Ms. Crosby. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Chair Butler and members of the committee. I'm J.L. Wilson. I represent NFIB. And I did testify in favor of this bill when it was on the Senate side, and I'll give pretty much the same testimony here. I wanted to kind of set a – this issue is kind of one of perception that sets the stage for how a small business person perceives dealings with agencies. You know, most – over well, about 60% of my members employ fewer than five people. They have gross sales of $300,000 on average. Their average salary is $35,000. They have – because of a lack of time and resources, they have serious constraints and they're really hamstrung in their ability to deal with agencies when they are in fact in conflict. And I do support 666 in its entirety, including the sections in question, which I believe are sections 7 through 12. Because when you're talking about, and I should also say, this bill was brought to my attention by two NFIB members, and I should also mention that a third member is one of those high-profile cases that Verlina mentioned. When you're dealing with disputes with regard to independent contractors, the presumption is that there is an employment relationship. In other words, the burden of proof is on the business owner to prove that there's an independent contracting relationship. Then you go one step beyond that, and then the department assesses the back taxes against you and something like that. The assessment is proof correct. And furthermore, I really don't see any language in statute that provides an incentive for the department to get its numbers right. I don't think that's the department's fault, but I don't really see any statutory incentive. So that seems to be two strikes against the business owner. And then the third is that there's no process for discovery in the hearings process. And, you know, discovery allows for a proper rebuttal. It allows for a small business owner to find out how the employment department got its assessment numbers. And in the absence of that, you really don't know how to defend yourself. So it just seems, at least from the perception, is the deck is stacked against a small employer in a dispute situation. Now, if independent contracting law is black and white, then I might not be here before you today, but the bottom line is the high-profile case that Verlina mentioned is there precisely because the Department of Revenue and the Employment Department don't agree on what an independent contractor is. One says they are independent contractors, the other says they're not independent contractors. So not even the agencies agree. So I'm not really sure how you expect a business person to follow the letter of the law, especially when they're busy running their business. And I might mention, you know, when Chair Butler said $800,000 to defend themselves, this particular woman, she's just like you or I, has spent many hundreds of thousands of dollars up to this point, and I really wouldn't wish that on anybody. So I do endorse 666, at least from as a matter of perception, it does a credible job of, I think, leveling the playing field, and that the assessment is not presumed correct, that the department has the burden of proving that that assessment is correct. It provides some statutory incentive in terms of lawyer's fees for that assessment to be as accurate as possible, and it does allow for discovery so a business person knows how to properly rebut what's been brought against them. So that's the extent of my comments, and I do support the bill.
Thank you very much. Questions for J.L.? Senator Farnell?
I just want to comment about the record. I thought on your example you gave
800 to 1,000.
Yeah. It must have sounded like 800,000 when you said 800.
No, for a laundress it was only 800 to 1,000.
I just wanted to clarify that for the record because that got my attention as well.
The jail's client has spent tens of thousands of every time. Mm-hmm.
Chair Butler, hundreds.
Hundreds of thousands. Other questions for JL? Mr. Wilson? Thank you very much, JL. JL, let me just ask this, recognizing some of the final comments relative to the bill from the department, that some of the language moving the scope of the discovery outside of the current Administrative Procedures Act, that this bill is going to meet the demise of the veto stamp up in the governor's office. Do you have any angst about that, to push a bill like this through without any further work, substantive work, just to see it killed in the governor's office, vetoed?
Chair Butler, I've never been one to advocate for legislation just to make a point. I'm interested in the signature, and of course it of course it gives me pause. Of course it does.
Representative Johnson is recognized.
I guess this is just a philosophical question, that you have one member who is in the process of litigating a dispute. You've said on the record that this cost has cost your member hundreds of thousands of dollars. I guess the philosophical question is, do you think the courts are an appropriate place to resolve those kinds of philosophical differences or legislation?
Chair Butler, Representative Johnson, I would certainly like to see those kinds of disputes preempted by legislation, and whatever you can do to circumvent those kind of disputes, if you can get that into legislation, I think that that is the superior way to go. Once it's gone beyond that point, then obviously the courts seem to be the best venue to settle those kind of things. But to answer your question directly, of course, I would like to be able to preempt those kind of disputes with whatever I could get into statute first.
Does your member expect to get relief under this bill if it's passed and signed by the governor?
This member is well past the point of getting relief under this bill.
Further questions from Mr. Wilson? Thank you, JL. We have Tim Nesman signed up. Nesman?
Good morning, Chair Butler, members of the committee. I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon FL-CIO, also a member of the Employment Department Advisory Council. And I'm not an attorney, I'm not a practitioner in this area, and so the comments I'm making are based on, first of all, our own commitment as State Federation to clear factors in the law so that persons who are employed as workers are, in fact, treated as workers and employers pay the proper payroll taxes due for their employment. And secondly, as a member of the Employment Department Advisory Council and having heard the discussion among both employer representatives and labor representatives about the status of this law and the few cases which have become contentious surrounding it, we're persuaded that, as JL says, it probably is more a matter of perception because I think what we're dealing with here are disagreements over outcomes under what has become a fairly settled area of the law. And I think we may have some employers who've been unhappy with how the law is applied, although we think it's been clearly and fairly applied, so that they're using the administrative procedures in the courts to try and basically create new law. We submit that if the case is to be made for changing the factors, that you should deal with the factors. In fact, you're making one modest change in them currently to update so websites count like business cards as proof of self-employment status. I think one would expect that in an area like this, especially where this agency is on point both for itself, the Employment Department and the Revenue Department, having to resolve these, there are going to be some contentious cases and some employers are unhappy with the outcome. But again, we think the surveys show and the discussions I've heard at the Advisory Council on the part of employer representatives as well as labor representatives that the process works well and the agency administers it fairly. I really think if you look carefully at the agency's letter and the criticisms of Section 7 to 14, because that's what we focus, not the remainder of the bill, that changing the burden on the tax assessments, changing the burden of proof as proposed here really is kind of a catch-22 for the agency, because there are employers who refuse to provide adequate documentation or fail to provide adequate documentation. And to then place the burden of proof on the agency to establish the correct tax rate when they're not getting all the information they need is truly a catch-22. And I think Ms. Crosley has adequately presented the other issues, the precedents that would be established here in terms of attorney fees at the ALJ level and so on, which are troubling. And again, just on behalf of the Advisory Council, we voted unanimously to oppose these changes to the bill, and we'd hope you would reject them as well. Thank you,
Mr. Nesman. Just one question that I had, and that was the comment that Mr. Wilson has made, and that is, what incentive is there to get the tax rate right when they come in and assess this business is. Can you help me with that, please?
I believe that the incentive is to get it right in the first place and not have to incur any appeals. I don't think the employment department wants to have to go through appeal on these, and if they're given adequate information, I think their record is such that they do a good job of getting it right.
So as far as you know, then, the normal tax rate that's applied in a case of a discovered employer, discovered employee relationship of an existing employer, the majority of the time that rate that they apply is the correct rate.
I actually can't speak to that, Mr. Chair, because, again, I'm not a practitioner in this area. I defer to the department to give you a better answer than I could.
Thank you. Representative Patridge?
I just wondered if there's been any discussion on the advisory piece that you sit on regarding the disconnect that Mr. Wilson talked about between revenue declaring them an independent contractor and the employment department declaring them an independent contractor, and how to marry those two pieces up.
In my recollection, discuss the revenue department piece. So perhaps Ms. Crosley can add something to that I couldn't understand.
Representative Johnson recognized?
I guess I'd like to make a plug, given that you sit on the Labor Management Advisory Council and given that Ms. Crosley is there, I'd like to make a plug that if openings become available, that at least consideration be given to making sure that the smallest employers would have a voice at that table, and not just the Freddies of the world.
I think Ms. Crosley can respond to that better, but Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, I do know we have several small employers, including a representative of a helicopter company in Southern Oregon, and
say that you've said enough. That's one helicopter representative. That's fine.
and in fact, I believe that viewpoint is represented.
Thank you.
I would just put in a plug as well for geographic representation.
Absolutely.
It's from Southern Oregon.
And a helicopter company. That would get any better than that.
Cover Eastern Oregon right there. Huh? Thank you very much.
Can I ask Rolina that question?
Yeah, I think we need to invite Rolina back up and make sure that we get that differing agency opinion issue, as well as getting the tax rate right.
Mr. Chair and members, I had forgotten that was a part of that particular case. There's been one case since 1989, happens to be the case that J.L. talked about, where there's been a difference. What happened was there was a settlement, as I understand it, Donna says as well. Department of Revenue's conference officer at their administrative level, we call it adjudication level, within the department, made an error in application. At the Department of Revenue, they have admitted that. When it went to the courts, they remanded it back to us to show why we did not use that. We have done that and sent it back up to the court. So it is an error of application rather than, in our mind, an improper application. That is not their argument, so I want to make sure, but that's our argument. But we are in litigation on that one, and we have sent that back up. And we do not agree with the Department of Revenue conference officer. He has admitted he inappropriately applied the law, and we are taking it back up to the court. So that was the reason why there was such a difference. And that's one case since 1989.
Okay. Other questions? At this time, we've had the public hearing. I'm going to go ahead and just close the public hearing, and I would like an opportunity to perhaps work with a couple of the folks that are involved, including the agency and perhaps some of the small business representatives, visit with these folks. So this time, I'll use my prerogative in just closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 666, and we'll open a public hearing and possible work session at 665. Senate Bill 665. We'll need a legislative fiscal analyst.
You'll
be welcome.
Yes, that's exactly.
Can you give us the information on 665? five?
I will. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have at your place a memo from me that describes Senate Bill 665A that requires people to apply in person for identification card, driver's permit, or a driver's license, provide a birth certificate or photo ID before the Department of Transportation replaces the document. Current law only requires that applicants provide proof of address and any other information that the department deems necessary. And on the back is the fiscal impact of this bill. The bill would require 1.5 FTE, $173,000 to implement. This bill is referred to Ways and Means from the Senate.
I think this was the Senate Transportation Committee public affairs.
Before it became public affairs.
Do we?
Yes, it was. I remember this bill.
Oh.
Do you know the nature of the nexus behind the bill?
We get a lot of bad ID out there.
I think we only required before.
A couple of pieces of information.
Yeah, only address. And now, because of...
go ahead. Other picture ID?
Yes. And
on the staff measure summary, they said that proponents explain that it is easy to obtain a duplicate ID card or driver's license. The ID card can then be used to cash checks and make other transactions using the new identification, and that's becoming more and more of a problem. That's all I know about this bill.
That's exactly right,
tonight. Just, I know maybe Representative Byer, I know he had a bill on identity theft last time, I think, that made it through the process. I'm happy to vote for this bill, but I just think it puts more of a burden on individuals within our district. Most people, I have a passport, but, a lot of people don't have a passport.
Because you might need to get out of town in a hurry.
Because I might need to get out of town in a hurry, but... most people don't have a passport. A lot of people don't have a birth certificate lying around. So, I don't know. I lost my license before when I was out of town. I went in, I had an envelope. They identified me based on, they have our pictures already that come up on the DMV. They pull our pictures on the DMV computer and look and see.
That looks like them.
But I'm happy to vote for it if it's a problem. But
customers would be exempt according from the. Does everyone have this in their? This is the summary from
the fiscal impact.
Fiscal impact.
I don't think we got.
I don't have it.
It's on the back of your memo.
How trees.
Go ahead and read that, please, Deb.
Yes, but this, maybe this is the same thing. Customers would be exempt from this requirement if DMV is able to verify identification by examining an electronically stored duplicate photo image. So if you already have done this on the photo, you would be fine.
So if you've been in one time and have been able to identify you through that other electronic system, and it talks about the software being already in place, but they'll need additional software to enable field offices, and I assume that additional software is software that we're already putting in to accommodate this.
Mm-hmm. If this bill passes, that's what part of the fiscal impact is about, is having to put that software in place.
Continue in new field offices.
In existing field offices.
So they don't have the ability to call up as Representative Patrick's indicated.
Apparently not, no.
Representative Smith is recognized.
Thank you, Chair Beller. One possible application from this is, let me tell you a quick story that happened 15 years ago. And it's not a personal story. I just happen to know about this story.
Sitting around the campfire.
Yeah, have I given enough?
Have you given enough disclaimer?
Thank you. A person who is 19 years old who has the same identical images of a person who's 21, both 6 foot, both blonde, both blue eyes, can walk into the DMV and say, "Hi, I'm Greg Smith, and I've lost my license." and they'd say, oh, okay, here's a new one. Well, now this person has a license that they can use on Friday night for their purposes as they may see fit. And so I think this will help address that issue. And while I have no personal experience with that, I just know 15 years ago this is something that happened.
Where the passage is recognized.
They're not having much fun in Eastern Oregon if they're suddenly on a Friday night. But they're using that. But anyway. Mr. Chair. Are we in work session?
We are in work session. We open a hearing in work session.
I move Senate Bill 665 to the full committee with your passport today.
You've heard the recommendation, Representative Patridge. Are there any objections? Further discussion? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. We'll move that with the due pass recommendation, the full. And Representative Patridge, will you carry that to full?
Yeah.
And to the, let's see, it goes back to the Senate. Is that correct?
It was your story.
Should we assign that from here?
Yes.
Okay. Senator Yee, would you like to carry that? And Representative Patridge, would you want to carry that for House? Okay. Or would we have our storyteller?
No, I prefer not to.
Okay.
I'll be happy to tell the story of Representative Smith on the House floor.
That being the case, that finishes our business for today. Thank you very much. We'll close the session.